We all agree these were very loosely knit together topics in finance. So let me see. The Master Settlement Agreement funded the Legacy Foundation, which doesn't do anything in coverage initiatives, really, and probably, as we found, did more to pay for chlamydia treatment than it did tobacco cessation. So if that can be some way to knit together the topics. I'm a faculty member in health policy and management at Georgia State University and the University of Georgia's College of Public Health. And my area of research expertise is actually public finance and budgeting. That's where I've done all my doctoral work and research, but I've done all of my work in the area of health. So the Master Settlement Agreement presented itself as sort of an interesting area of analysis from a financing side. And so most of my work has appeared in public budgeting and finance and public policy areas. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from a public health standpoint in terms of what has gone wrong with the Master Settlement Agreement and what might we have done better on the front end. So I'll talk to you very generally. The research is fairly detailed, and I won't go through all of that, but to tell you, most folks know what the Master Settlement Agreement is, but I'm not sure that people fully understand some of the nuances. I'm a bit about budget processes and how we treat revenue streams. A look at the factors that appear to have influenced state allocation behaviors, and then some discussion around policy and what we in the health field really should be thinking about in terms of future considerations. As we're sitting here having a dialogue with our elected officials about funding SCHIP expansion with a tobacco tax, is there something that we should be learning from previous behavior in that area? So having said that, the Master Settlement Agreement came out of litigation that initially began in Mississippi, and then every state decided to pile on and sue the tobacco companies. 46 states ended up in a conglomerate settlement called the Master Settlement Agreement. 4 states settled independently with 4 major tobacco companies, and to Pat's point, no, I do not have a conflict. The tobacco companies did not fund my research, although I interviewed a lot of them in the process. To compensate states for what were alleged to be prior losses on health care costs, on the Medicaid side as well as uncompensated care, okay? It set forth in that agreement some restrictions on tobacco marketing and corporate behavior and funded the Legacy Foundation, which is really a small portion, and for those of you that are familiar with Legacy, you know that the money is running out. And Legacy has done a number of things to encourage decreased utilization, but they alone certainly cannot tackle that problem. The key thing is, and where the windfall really came out of the Master Settlement Agreement, is this enormous unrestricted revenue stream that has come to the 46 states. And the commitment is at least for 25 years. The initial allocation occurred in 2000 for most states, 2000-2001. So states will be funded until 2025 at a minimum, unless all 4 of those companies go bankrupt, which it doesn't appear that they're doing anytime soon, with quite a lot of money. What does it look like? It's about 2% of states' general revenues. So it's more than any lottery or special revenue source, and it is, again, a completely unrestricted revenue when it comes to the state. So it looks and walks and talks like general revenue. And for most states, it goes straight into the general revenue for allocation. So what my initial research question was is what factors really influence states' behaviors. Now, if you think of the contentions in the litigation, it was to address health problems in the state. So in the theoretical construct of what would influence states' budgeting behavior, the predominant rational characteristic ought to be the health status or spending on health. But knowing a bit about budgeting, I also understand there are political issues, economic conditions, what kind of processes actually occur in the state, because states have very different means of allocating dollars or setting up performance budgeting. supplantation restrictions, etc. And then competition from other systems like education, transportation, etc. So the backdrop, of course, in budgeting is, for those of you that have had public finance classes, you understand budgeting tends to be incremental. You don't see states or even Congress. I mean, that's our system was set up with three branches of government, so we do nothing dramatic or quickly. That you'd have to go to a parliamentary system to get dramatic or quickly. So budgeting tends to be incremental. We try very hard in the budgeting research to say, no, it's rational, comprehensive, but frankly, it's not. We move at the margin, and the changes are small. Once revenue gets absorbed into funding streams, we do have a zero-sum game, and it's very difficult to reallocate. So the time you have to move in for capture is when it first comes down, because once you've created a constituency and a funding pattern, it's really hard to change. Once things become general revenues, they become part of the base. And frankly, Michael Moore, who was at the time Attorney General in Mississippi, he brought the first litigation. He said, you know, the biggest mistake we made was letting it become general revenue, because the flow immediately loses its identity. And in the elected and legislative world, all money is fair game. And that's a lesson we haven't learned very well, frankly, on the health side, is that somehow we believe that we had an inalienable right to this MSA money. So what did states initially do, and I apologize that this is small, but here's how states allocated money, even from the beginning, and this is actually a number and percentage of states actually utilizing funds by these expenditure categories. Even in the beginning, tobacco control and health funding was not universally used by everybody. Some states even took the dollars and said, we'll put it into offsetting taxes. But at least at some level, a portion of the states reported using the money for tobacco control at some level. But then as the years go by, it gets less and less. But more significantly, in terms of actual dollars, okay, now remember that all states' allocations in this process, and I'll show you some of that, aren't equal. How the money got divided on a per capita basis and a total basis is quite different, which deals with some equity issues. But by about 2005, of the total amount of money, less than 7% of it's being spent on tobacco control. About 35%, this is an average of averages among the states, is being spent on health. But the critical thing to realize with health is that it's not new money. And that's what the research helps us identify, is it's actually offsetting cost. The biggest amount of money has really gone to regular operating, economic development, securitization, which is actually taking the money up front through bond issues to go and offset a deficit spending. Okay, so at the end of the day, less than half of the money at any level is really being used for health. However, and these are the trends over time. Now, remember that when we got the money, simultaneously that was the biggest downturn that we've faced in state budgets in 20 some odd years. And so the MSA money came at a quite inopportune time. It remains to be seen whether had economic conditions been different, we would have spent it any differently. But the analysis actually looked at the way states invested using independent variables that captured economic and employment conditions, healthcare needs based on health status, lung cancer rates, smoking rates, et cetera, and then their budget processes. And in short order to say, the only things that really had clearly identifiable influences in regression analysis, looking across, again, rational factors, is state party control. Republicans were less likely to invest in health than Democrats. Population factors and Medicaid expenditures. But the interesting thing about Medicaid expenditures, and this is what's given this research a lot of traction, is that higher Medicaid expenditures in a state meant that they spent less of their master settlement agreement on health. And that's because what we're probably seeing is a crowding out factor, that because states that had richer Medicaid portfolios actually were in greater budget crisis in the early 2000s. And then, again, nothing about smoking rates or health status had any relationship with states' funding patterns. Economic factors, particularly employment conditions, definitely influenced MSA spending in the states. And those states that had higher unemployment rates clearly needed the MSA to invest it in other areas of spending. Health status concerns had absolutely no relationship, and that's probably from the research that's been done from the health advocacy and health promotion standpoint. The question always comes up, why did this happen? We can't find anything that seems to influence why our state didn't spend this money. We had an advocacy coalition. We had a whatever. The problem was that was not a driver in the decision-making. It was a driver for the people negotiating the settlement, but not a driver in terms of the folks that were doing the budgeting. Medicaid expenditures did appear to have an influence for states that ended up using the money really sort of contrary to the preambles of the Master Settlement Agreement. And again, there's a whole series of research around incremental versus rational comprehensive budgeting behavior, but what you are seeing is the structural imbalance in the states there that Medicaid expenditures is really causing. That states that have been aggressive in expanding their Medicaid portfolio have found themselves in the early 2000s in quite a budget crisis, because it is the growing gorilla in state health expenditures because the feds aren't doing anything. Procedural aspects of budgeting. A few state advocacy folks said, hey, we should put in laws against supplantation, and that'll mean that we can't use the MSA money to offset other things. Interestingly enough, those states, and for those of you that have lotteries in your state, it's a pretty standard trick to put in a law that says you don't use these additional revenues to offset what was already funded. States that had anti-supplantation provisions ended up spending the money completely counter to those laws because legislatures can't bind themselves. So those laws really mean nothing, and that's been found traditionally in the lottery research through the years. So, again, it's part of what are the lessons that we as health financers need to learn to play this game more effectively. Political factors, political culture, more conservative states, frankly, and Republican states did behave slightly differently, but not consistently differently. And that's the challenge, is you can't actually predict how people are going to lockstep. Another interesting finding, which is not necessarily surprising, but a lot of folks didn't think about, tobacco-producing states consistently and still do invest their MSA money in paying tobacco growers. That is the one certainty that has come out of the MSA, and that is even in the face, for those of you that are familiar with the nuances of the Master Settlement Agreement, there were two Master Settlement Agreements. The one big one, and then Master Settlement Agreement Phase 2, which went to help the tobacco growers bridge what was anticipated to be a huge reduction in tobacco growing. The Master Settlement Agreement 2 ended up being repealed or basically set aside at the time that we did the buyout. that Congress passed the buyout. So the purchase of quotas set that aside. But even in the face of phase two, states still were spending a ton of money on tobacco growing communities and tobacco farmers, and that is still consistently true. Budgeting behavior, again, with the MSA tends to be incremental, and once those dollars ended up in a pot of money, we saw very little shift after that first little bump in 2002. And again, in times of extreme fiscal stress, what we found is in the budgeting literature, we're now calling this punctuated equilibrium, that they will actually respond to economic conditions more so than political factors. But then once that stress goes by, they're back down in traditional budgeting patterns. And so this money is now all absorbed in operating expenses in the states. So what are some of the policy considerations? First of all, from an economics and equity standpoint, I'll just say these are the per capita funding rates for use of the MSA, and what we have are donor states and benefactor states. For those of you that know much about the taxation literature, you understand that. We have a lot of, from a per capita standpoint, the distribution is quite uneven. And so it was who got to be, you know, at the negotiating table, who ended up with very different rates of return. So you have a lot of states, that, particularly poorer states, that are giving a fair amount of money to richer states that happen to have lower smoking rates. Again, in terms of funding, because the funding is based on the price of a pack of cigarettes, The other thing is that we really need to think about, it seems like a good idea, this notion of litigation as a policy tool, but what does it get us at the end of the day? And is it a policy tool, or should it really be used as a means to generate revenue? And we're, of course, there's been tons of exploration about should we start doing this with foods around the obesity crisis. We need to think very long and hard about whether we want to use litigations as a means to control behavior or a means to fund state operations. And they're two quite different things. And possibly re-looking at the Master Settlement Agreement gives us some things. How did we get 46 states to agree to the settlement? They probably, right, gave away a lot in terms of what they were around negotiating. And again, remember, you had early leaders who really were engaged in this litigation as a means of trying to control the tobacco manufacturers. The others piled on, okay? And so at the end of the day, those who negotiated really weren't the ones that would end up spending it. This is just sort of an interesting look at smoking, lung cancer rates compared to investment of MSA funds for tobacco control. And as you can see, there is no relationship between those states that had high lung cancer rates and used the money to actually begin to address control of tobacco use. And so going forward, states that got this infusion of MSA money were able to get themselves out of a fiscal crisis. The money has now been absorbed. They probably haven't corrected structural revenue imbalances that, frankly, will come back to haunt all of our states going forward. There's a probable, likely lack of commitment to the agreement. The people who negotiated the settlement were the attorneys general, who have nothing to do with budgeting policy. Legislators and governors weren't even at the table, really. I mean, ultimately, they had to agree to it, but somebody said, hey, here's your $150 million. Do you want to take this? Absolutely. And no strings attached. The states that securitized, interestingly enough, we complained about that. You know what securitization is? They took the money up front. But in many cases, some of those people some of those states used it for quite good health capital investments. Schools of public health. Large structural infusions of dollars that frankly freed them from being beholden to the tobacco companies anymore. They've sold that marker. So they don't care whether Philip Morris goes up or down. Some of you may remember the large judgment against Philip Morris when the state's attorneys general came and said, oh no, judge, you must set that aside. We need the money. So we have made a pact with potentially our greatest enemy, and we rely on their money now. For those states that securitize, they don't care. They're done with it. They got the money, and some of them set up pretty standard investment streams. Earmarking, if we ever do it again, we can't have general revenue. It's just not going to work. There's got to be a standardized investment stream. And from a tax purpose standpoint, what is it we really intend going forward? If we raise the price of tobacco, do we do that to generate money? Or do we do it to suppress use? And the problem is, in the advocacy community, we want to do it to suppress use. But we sell it to our public officials as a way to raise money. And that's exactly the dilemma we face with S-CHIP now. Is if we do that to create a revenue stream, then we're not really serious about getting tobacco off the street. We may be, but our elected officials suddenly depend on the money. So what do we need to think about going forward? At a minimum, we need to be much better versed in budgeting and from a public health and health finance standpoint. And I think probably for those of you that are interested in health finance out of health administration, you know, it's pretty hard to find people in the field who are doing financing research. And it makes us in a difficult situation in terms of being at the negotiating table. Litigation is probably a great tool for punishment and a remedy and changing behavior. It's probably not the best tool for generating funding streams. And we need to think long and hard about whether that's something we want to use going forward. The imbalance between treatment and prevention in the U.S. is going to consistently drive resources. And so states, again, that have invested large amounts of the MSA into actual health care have done it to offset Medicaid treatment costs, not really to stop smoking. And even the states, anybody from Massachusetts? Even the states that invested a bunch of money in prevention up front, they didn't sustain that commitment very long. You know, it was just too easy to take the dollars away from cessation programs and prevention programs and move them into the treatment avenue or something else. Unrestricted revenue is going to be unrestricted revenue. The states are going to spend it where they need it, no matter who negotiated the compromise. Electoral time frames make it really impossible to sustain deals. The people who negotiated the master settlement agreement, most of them aren't even in elected office anymore. And actually, the lead AG, Christine Gregoire, who's now the governor in Washington State. Anybody from Washington State? They've taken most of their money and used it in completely different ways other than the original commitment. So if you negotiate using personalities, they are in fact fleeting. And using sin taxes as a means to create a revenue stream means that we bind ourselves long-term to the devil. And that's okay if that's what we want to do, but we need to understand that you can't sell it as if we raise taxes, they'll quit smoking, because states depend on tax revenues, and they won't want people to quit smoking. So we have to think long and hard about this 25-year deal, at least 25-year deal, that we have forged for public health. So thank you.
Anyone have questions for Valerie?
know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think... it's brought fairly little. Right. Well, probably the lesson of that is never underestimate the tobacco companies. They are good. And if we could take a chapter from their playbook. But having said that, you know, I think probably one of our dilemmas in public health is we tend not to back things unless we think we do get a result out of it. And probably we should be more at the table in broader financing negotiations to understand how that game is played, and so that there can be, frankly, don't take this the wrong way, some quid pro quo. I mean, we ought to be at the table in, if you're from Colorado, you should have been there for Tabor, you know, because if you've got tax and expenditure limitations, it's going to kill health, because health is 30% of any budget. So sort of yes and no, but we need to be smarter about the expectation, and I think we believed in the Master Settlement Agreement we were getting more than we were ever going to get. Right.
The lesson of general funds is one that in public health you learn very early, but I would argue we actually got a lot from the Master Settlement, particularly if you look at the success that you see all over the country in driving down smoking rates. We aren't done. But...
Yeah. To me, the question is, did you get an extra $10 or more than nothing? But the question is, did you really, I mean, a lot of public health groups were really behind this, really pushing for it, and they didn't get much for it. And what I'm saying is, you know, and something where politically, you know, like government working people can't, but health advocates and agencies can. They can kind of say, look, we're not going to back something unless...
Well, and the other thing is, you know, there's a fair amount of debate about whether the Master Settlement Agreement has driven down smoking rates or whether it's been the collective policy interventions that have to do with, you know, laws banning smoking in public places and local tax initiatives. So it's been a number of things, and certainly the Master Settlement Agreement further demonized the industry, which is essential, but it also created a really horrible, unholy alliance. States are ultimately going to have to carve that 2% out of somewhere. I mean, smoking rates are going down, thankfully, but that also drives payments down. Most of our states are losing millions of dollars every year that they've got, you know, somewhere in the education budget or something. So the difficulty is not the Master Settlement Agreement itself, but how we let probably that process get negotiated. It's probably the only way we could have done it. Most of the principals would tell you you couldn't have achieved agreement any other way. But at the end of the day, to have expected that somehow there was going to be a windfall for prevention programs was probably fairly unrealistic on our part.
Oh, so